You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 205. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I am recording for you in my palatial basement here in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, we have like 35 different people. I'm not even going to try to introduce everyone because I really don't have that mental capacity right now. So I'm just going to run through you guys and you can say who you are and where you are, and we'll go that way. So Mr. John Gentile.
What's up, all you hot cats out there? This is John Gentile coming at you from my secret underground lair in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
No one else is going to put that much effort into it. Okay, who else we got here? Mark.
Hi, this is Mark from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, also known as Mr. Spike on the website. Not so secretly as John.
All right, do we have Ricky on tonight's show?
I'm right here, coming from to you from Los Angeles, California.
Coming to you. Why do we always say that? It's such a weird thing.
You know what? I'm just going with it. You know,
we're there. We're there for the people. And Mr. Joe Pallone.
Hey, Punk News and Dad's Not Punk.
Yeah.
Contributor Joe Pallone, arriving near your vicinity from Norristown, Pennsylvania.
That was nicer. How's it going? How's your children?
Amazing. I got one children.
Yeah, but one is like six.
It's great. He's 19 months now, walking, doing a lot of gibberish, interacting a little bit. How's your family?
Like you, Joe.
Yeah.
Mine is the exact same age, and yeah, running around, saying a lot of things, climbing on stuff, getting irrationally angry. That's pretty much how this works. So yeah, I guess we mentioned like our blog that we don't update. We should probably tell people about that so they can go not read it. So a bunch of like the Punk News dads, when we all had children, started this blog called dadsnotpunk.com. And we've blogged on there like six times. And then we all realized that having kids is a lot of work and you don't want to write about it because it's exhausting. So we haven't. So if you want like barely any content, that's where you can not find it. So yeah, that's Dad's Not Punk. Anyway, so on tonight's show,
that's an excellent plug.
Yeah, I thought so.
Updates for 2014.
Yeah, when we're really trying, then we'll give it a real thing. So, anyways, we have a huge show. Lots of stuff happened this past week. The first one is really the big one. It's the thing that's really dominated the punk news universe over this past week. So. It's a sad one, and I guess we're just going to have to get into it first. So this was the death of Tommy Ramone. the legend and punk rock icon. He died last week. So according to Variety and the New York Rocker Magazine publisher Andy Schwartz, Tommy Ramone of the Ramones had passed away. The cause of death was related to the treatment of cancer of the bile duct. Now, Tommy, who was born Thomas Erdely, I'm never good at his name. Erdely?
It's a Erdely? Hungarian name, I think.
Yeah, his real name isn't even Thomas. It's like the Hungarian version of Thomas.
Okay, so his real name was something else. formed a band with John Cummings, who would later become Johnny Ramone, called the Tangerine Puppets when they were both teenagers. After that band dissolved, Cummings formed a new band, which would then become the Ramones. Tommy was originally supposed to just be the manager, but ended up drumming on the band's first three records before deciding to leave the band as a musician. However, Tommy would continue to serve as a producer and songwriter for the band at various points in their career. Before his passing, Tommy Ramone was the last surviving member of the original quartet. So we had the privilege of actually speaking with Tommy back in 2005, and there's a link to the interview there on Punk News that you can find. So yeah, this happened. We have no more remaining Ramones around. John, I'll throw this one out to you first. You're the historian here.
Well, I mean, first of all, the importance of the Ramones and the importance of Tommy Ramone cannot be overstated. And all the Ramones were essential to the Ramones. For some reason, the past 5 or 6 years, people like to say, oh, this Ramone didn't really do anything, or that Ramone didn't. Let me tell you, people, every single of the original Ramones, and even the Ramones after that, were essential to the sound of the Ramones. And there would not be any Ramones without Joey. There would not be any Ramones without Johnny. There would not be any Ramones without Dee Dee. And certainly there would not be any Ramones without Tommy, because he really – I mean – what's the backbone of the Ramones sound? The drums and the guitar, that buzz attack. And if you don't have Tommy Ramone doing that hard driving beat, you would not have the Ramones. So, I mean, you could argue that Tommy Ramone created the punk rock beat. And if he didn't, he was certainly very, very, very influential in it. So, I mean, what else can you say that it's sad? I've said this before. Go see the legends while you can, because when they die, it's too late. I never got the chance to see any of the original Ramones, actually. Tommy did have a band. I forget, it was called like Mad Uncle or something like that, but they played very few shows. It was kind of like a folk act. But it's sad that he's passed away. So the point is, I guess there is a silver lining, I guess, in that for a while people were turning against the Ramones. I remember a couple people were saying that like so-and-so pop punk band did the Ramones better than the Ramones ever did, which was ridiculous. And if somebody said it to me in person, I would punch them. But the fact is, people, I think, are respecting and loving the Ramones again, as they should. They're probably the greatest bands. And, well, they're definitely one of the greatest bands ever. And if you said to me they're the greatest band ever, I wouldn't argue with you. And Mark Little says that Tommy Ramone's band was called Uncle Monk. So check that out. Check out the Ramones. I listened to those first three albums. I listen to the Ramones fairly frequently. I listen to them like once every 2 months or so. But after Tommy passed away, I listened to like all basically the first six albums in a row. So good. I mean, you cannot overstate how great the Ramones are. Such a great band. And that's all I can say.
Now, you guys embarked on a little Ramones review project like right after this news broke, and you turned it around fairly quickly, right?
That's how we roll, baby. Punk news. Yeah, what happened is we actually had some Ramones, and actually Ricky wrote a review. Ricky did Leave Home. Mark did Rocket to Russia, and Joe Pallone did Ramones Mania. We had Ramones reviews in the database, but they really weren't that great, so we said, now's the perfect time to, you know, pay tribute to Tommy Ramone and update our reviews. And I think everybody, all the guys, did a super quick job and did an awesome job of turning them around. So if the guys want to talk about their favorite albums or Tommy Ramone, I think that'd be fitting.
Yeah, I got to tell you that when I saw the news first, like late Friday night, when it was kind of floating around, it wasn't confirmed yet. I was really hoping it wasn't true. And when I woke up the next morning and I saw that it was confirmed, I felt kind of punched in the gut because, you know, while I never thought that the band was going to get back together in any sense of the word, to know that none of the Ramones were together or none of the Ramones were still alive was just kind of hard to deal with, really. And I saw a picture that was circulating on the internet. I'm sure you guys saw it also, where it was the first album cover where they'd airbrushed out all the members and just showed the blank wall. And that was really just kind of stirring for me. And just like you, John, I listened to all the records constantly over the weekend, and being able to write that review, actually, that was kind of an honor for me, because the Ramones were really important to me when I was growing up, and they're still really important to me now. And anybody that hasn't seen the documentary End of the Century definitely needs to check it out, because that was it's just really a great look at a band that unfortunately I don't think was appreciated until they went away.
Yeah, I remember seeing that I saw the airbrush picture also, and that's when it really hit me that they're all gone. I also recently just watched Rock and Roll High School for like the third time, and then I also listened to all the albums, but I gotta tell you, like, doing Leave Home was pretty cool. I did not know that there was that whole controversy with Carbona, that Carbona song.
Yeah, Carbona, not Clue. Yeah.
About the name, yeah.
So, but no, I love the Ramones growing up. They were like a nice, like, intro to punk rock that wasn't like too heavy, but like still really, just like still had like some melody and simple stuff that sounded really great. And then what I thought was really weird was that Friday night when the news started circulating was that there were people posting links saying that it was a hoax. So no one was sure what was going on for a little bit. But unfortunately, it's true. So
yeah, that stemmed from there actually wasn't – like you see this a lot when people are sick. There was a death hoax like 3 days beforehand. And they said Tommy Ramone is dead, but he wasn't at the time, like 3 days beforehand. And there's like websites that say it's a hoax. So after he actually did die, people got confused and saw that website from a couple of days ago, but they thought it meant then. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know something? I never had any idea that he had been ill. I mean, honestly, it was a real surprise to me when I saw that. I mean, when Johnny was sick, you knew he'd been sick for a while, and the same thing with Joey. I was really surprised. It really caught me out of left field.
One other thing that I suggest people might want to take a look at is, there is a whole 30-minute interview on the Howard Stern Show E! Show of all the Ramones coming back together. It's awesome. Tommy, I don't think he's in it. I don't think Tommy's on it, but CJ is there, and the other three.
CJ and Marky.
Yeah.
Did anyone think when everyone was just posting all these missives and everything, where they were just saying like all the Ramones are dead, that like Marky or CJ were just kind of looking at that and going like, "Aw, man."
I think Marky is really the only one that really holds on to that. CJ seems to be pretty much, you know, proud of the time that he spent with the band, but I don't think he considers himself to be one of the brothers, so to speak. Marky really seems to be the one that's held on to it, that and Richie in a sort of way.
Actually, you know, Adam, Joe Pallone and I talked about this at when we saw Buzz Osborne two nights ago. Is I really have a profound amount of respect for Marky, and I think maybe Joe might disagree with me a little bit, but I really, people say, oh, Marky, he's just in it for the money, or you know, he's fake. But I respect Marky in that he's really the only guy that's keeping the Ramones dream alive, and when you go see him, you know, he's at least giving you a taste of what it was like to see the Ramones live for people that weren't able to see him. Like, Joe Pallone and I saw him play a whole Ramones set with Andrew W.K., and it was awesome. And it's just like how he did it in the Ramones, you know, short, fast, hard, you know, bopping tunes. So I really respect Marky Ramone for, I guess, carrying the Ramones banner and at least providing people that experience, at least to some degree.
I completely agree. I think he's the only one kind of still doing justice to the legacy.
Oh, so we agree.
We do agree. I do think it's weird that, like, he tried, like, if you want to compare Marky to Tommy, I mean, Tommy kind of aged a little more gracefully, and he went on to do other things. I didn't even notice he produced a Replacements record. Like, he kept doing his engineering thing.
Marky's he produced Tim.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Marky still got the same haircut, still doing Ramone songs. And that's cool because Ramones are a great band. And again, like John said, the live show is amazing. So I think that's where I make, you know, it's easy to kind of make fun of him because he's getting older. And he's still clinging to it.
All right. Well, I don't, you know, I don't know where we go with this one. It's definitely the end of an era, I guess. And we're
did anybody else get to see the Ramones?
I never did. I think that, God, I think that, like, the, you know, again, like, the closest I probably ever got was seeing, like, maybe when, like, Marky was playing with the Misfits or something like that.
I got into them when Joey Ramone died. That was my introduction.
Oh, wow. I got to see them in 90, I think it was 92 or 93 in Gainesville, actually.
Ooh.
So I can say I at least saw half the original band.
See, I hate playing this game because, like, my track record with seeing people that are, like, of that first era is really horrible because I will constantly miss them for dumb reasons and then they die. And it's, oh, God, like, it was one of those things, like Joe Strummer was like, oh, I, you know, I'm not going to drive all the way up to Toronto to go see Joe Strummer at a record store. That's, that's a lot of time. And then, like, boom, like, you know, it just, those sort of things keep happening. But, oh boy. All right, we're going to move on. Somehow.
We love the Ramones.
Yeah. Okay,
in conclusion, yay Ramones.
Okay, so we're going to keep going here. So, because there's lots of other stuff that happened this week.
Oh, can we play our Marky Ramone tribute? I mean, our Tommy Ramone tribute?
Our Richie Ramone tribute?
Elvis Ramone?
Yeah!
Yeah, okay, let's do that instead of whatever I was about to talk about, because that's way better. Okay, do that.
All right, so I'll explain it real quick, and then we'll play it. What we're going to do is we're going to play a couple of clips put together. The first clip that we're going to play is Tommy Ramone talking about Rockaway Beach and how it was written in 2000 sometime. Then for some reason, then he plays it on the acoustic guitar, which is neat. And then after that, we're going to follow it up with a recording from the It's Alive tour, but not from the It's Alive record. It's a Rockaway Beach live on the King Biscuit Flower Hour. And it's not the last Tommy Ramone show, but it's one of the last Tommy Ramone shows. So check it out.
The first New York City song I really liked was by The Love and Spoonful called Summer in the City. I don't know if too many people know about The Love and Spoonful, but they were like a really hip New York City band for the time. Really inspired a lot of fashion and everything. Lou Reed wrote a couple of great New York City songs, especially Walk on the Wild Side. Kind of captures the era of the early 1970s, what the nightlife was like for the hipper young people of the time. Rockaway Beach was written by Didi Ramone. He loved to get a tan and stuff like that. And then he wrote a song about hitching a ride to Rockaway Beach. And it was released in the middle of like December or January. It's one of those things where a summer song is released in the winter. But I think it's one of the best Ramone songs. June had a rhythm on my bubble gum. Sun is out, I want some. It's not hard, not far to reach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Up on the roof, down in the street. Down in the playground, hot concrete. Bus ride is too slow. Blast up the disco on the radio. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. It's not far, not hard to reach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. It's not far, not hard to reach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. June had a rhythm, I'm a bubble gum. Sun is out, I want some. It's not far, not hard to reach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Up on the roof, down in the street. Down in the playground, a concrete. Bus ride is too slow. Blast out the disco on the radio. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. We can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach. Rock, rock, Rockaway Beach.
We can meet you right to Rockaway Beach.
We're back. John, that was really cool. Thanks for grabbing that and putting it together for us.
My pleasure. For real. My pleasure.
All right. So we're going to talk about some of the other stuff that happened in the worldwide punk news world this past week. So first off, the new record from Joyce Manor was finally heard by the masses. Their new record, Never Hung Over Again, was streaming at NPR. You can find a link to stream it on Punk News, or if you have one of the digital music services, well, I guess only one, I think it is right now exclusively streaming on Cardio. Anyways, so the record, it is due out on the 22nd, which would be next Tuesday. And it follows up their 2012 full length of All Things I Will Soon Grow Tired. And this is, of course, the band's debut record on Epitaph. So do you guys give this thing a listen? Were you Joyce Manor fans before? Are you Joyce Manor fans now? Silence says probably not.
I listen to metal and Disney songs. That's about it. So if you want to talk about Tombs, I'll talk about Tombs.
And do you listen to baby metal?
Oh, I love that. Just grinding guitar, shrieking babies, a lot of blast beats.
You know, I listened to a couple of the songs. I never got this band for some reason. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but yeah.
I'm with you. I think I've been missing something as well. I listened to the first three songs of this record, and I've seen the commenters really go crazy over this band, and it's something that I've just really never gotten into.
Yeah, I know diehard fans, and I didn't think it was bad. I just don't know what I'm missing.
Exactly. That's exactly the way I feel about it as well.
Okay, I guess I'll be the guy that gives a crap.
Yay! Craps!
I've only spun this thing once and not paying a super amount of attention to it, so I can't really judge it, I guess, at this point compared to their other stuff. I think Joyce Manor's first record was really good, and partly the reason for it, and I've said this on the show a bunch of times, so forgive me to all three of our listeners who remember things that I've said before, but this band was good because their songs were short. And because they were, like, ostensibly pop punk songs, but they were delivered in a way that were, you know, they were brief, they never really overstayed their welcome, that were recorded in a way that was kind of, like, charmingly rough and didn't have all of those edges smoothed out that, this kind of band would normally have done in the studio. So if you go back and you listen to their self-titled debut from 2013 on Asian Man, you know, there were songs in there like Leather Jacket or Beach Community or Constant Headache that I think people are huge fans of because they kind of have that. They're poppy, but they're kind of shambling and fun. And I think it's a lot of the same reason why people like the sound of, say, like Weezer's Pinkerton, is because it, you know, it has that charmingly all over the place quality to it. Their last record, I was not as big a fan of it as their first one. And this one, I haven't had that much time really to really focus on it, I guess. But, you know, I'm just going by the length of the songs. They're still sticking with that, which was my major fear, is that they were going to get into the studio and Epitaph was going to, you know, throw. I don't even know who produces pop and punk bands anymore. Who is that guy that did all the ones back in the Blink era? What was his name?
Jerry Finn?
Yeah, they're going to throw Jerry Finn at him.
Right? Back from the dead.
Back from the dead. And they were going to sound like that. But I don't think that's the case. I'm just not sure if this is hooking me yet. It's too early in the Adam Joyce Manor listening experience to really know that. So yeah, I get why people like Joyce Manor. I still have this fear that someone external to the band is going to fuck them up at some point, but I don't think they've done that yet.
Is this record, I mean, like what you've heard of this record, is this like their earlier things? Because when you're talking about them being pop punk, it doesn't sound like what I would consider to be pop punk.
I'm not thinking pop punk so much as like sonically pop punk. I'm thinking pop punk as in like there's a lot of like there's some really nice kind of pop songwriting to it. And I think that plays into my worry about this band, is because you could take a lot of those songs and I could imagine like some like mustache twirling record executive listening to their first record or maybe even this record and going like these guys could be huge. We just need to, you know, add another bridge to this song, make it like 4 minutes long, have a, you know, maybe a rap interlude over here, or, you know, one of those, you know, however you can completely ruin a pop punk band by overthinking it. So I like that they haven't done that. They sound like them. They don't really sound like, I guess, you know, they don't sound like whatever pop punk band people are listening to. God, I'm out of it. I don't even know what pop punk bands kids are. Who's into what at this point? Like, what do the kids listen to? What is their pop punk du jour?
Well, see, pop punk's got like two definitions now. There's like the Ramones core, which is what I think of as pop punk, but there's also like Brand New, which they call pop punk. You know,
what do like horrible 16-year-olds listen to?
Falling in Reverse.
Okay, that's not even, all right, never mind. I'm pulled. So, I guess we're just gonna jump away from this because no one has anything to say about Joyce Manor outside of me. So, speaking of independent music, a bunch of independent labels have joined together to form the Fair Digital Deals Declaration Initiative. So, over 700 indie labels from across the world have united to form this initiative. It's being coordinated by something called WIN, which is the Worldwide Independence Network. This initiative has created 5 rules that all of the labels that are part of the initiative have to agree with. So these rules are, 1, they ensure that artists' share of download and streaming revenues is clearly explained in recording agreements and royalty statements in reasonable summary form. 2, they account to artists a good faith pro rata share of any revenues and other compensation from digital services that stem from the monetization of recordings but are not attributed to specific recordings or performances. 3, encourage better standards of information from digital services on usage and monetization of music. 4, support artists who choose to oppose, including publicly, unauthorized uses of their music. And 5, support the collective position of the global independent record company sector. So this is kind of like a I don't want to call it a lobbying group. Let's call it a lobbying group of independent labels that are going, hey, digital music exists. We should come up with some sort of rules and standards about that. Now, this matters for us in the punk news world because a lot of the labels that release stuff that we listen to are involved in this. Side One Dummies on here, Epitaph, Hellcat, Anti-Family, Fearless, Sumerian, Kill Rockstars, Beggars Group, Domino, Sub Pop, Merge, XL4AD, Matador, Drag City, Rough Trade, Tough Gong. So all
Buffalo
sorts of labels.
Soldier, Torn from the Caribbean. I was a buffalo. Sorry, Adam.
Okay. Anyways, all those labels are here. So the initiative comes in the wake of the rise of digital streaming services, where major stakeholders of those services are the major labels, and those labels are often given favorable deals, including things like guaranteed payment amounts and equity in the streaming companies, compared to the indies, which just kind of, you know, sign on and then get a check for 56 cents every 6 months. So, this thing exists. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm surprised this just came up because we were actually talking about this like two or three podcasts ago. I wouldn't say it's so much a lobbying group as more of a union. A lobbying group, like, tries to change the policies of a central authority, whereas it seems this is a bunch of smaller labels getting together to say, we will demand fair treatment or we won't be there, which I think is wonderful. I think it's been far too long that small artists have been abused. Well, I don't know if abuse is the right word, but have had too small of a leverage to get more of a revenue from streaming services. Will this make a difference? I hope it will. I wonder, like, do these labels have to account to anybody? What are the penalties if they don't abide by these rules? I know a couple of small labels that aren't part of it said, well, no one asked us to be a part of it, and we probably would be a part of it, so I hope it gets bigger. Also, I saw already some small labels were, like, criticizing it. That's the depth of every, you know, alternate thinking or small group of people is that because they have some minor differences, they just attack each other instead of attacking the big bully, which are these big streaming services that don't give anybody any money. So I really hope that these smaller labels can band together and get higher revenue from their streams, from streaming services to pay the artists. So I'm all for this. I think this is exactly what the music industry needs. And the more money for labels, the better. It kind of reminds me of Henry Rollins because, on one respect, John Gentile is a very ardent supporter of the power to contract. You can contract anything you want so long as it's legal, and I believe in that very deeply. The problem is, what if one side has done that so well that they can overpower everybody else? And that's exactly what has happened here. I mean, a small label doesn't have to stream to a streaming services, but then no one's going to hear them. And they're too small to set up their own streaming services that anybody's going to care about. So the idea is either you fund the big boys getting a much bigger chunk of the pie and you get almost nothing, or you're not there at all. Which really, that's just the result of contracting. But on the other hand, is I really respect small artists. And so I'm a little bit torn, but I think this is good. And I think that these guys should band together. And actually, in a way, this is just them exercising their own power to contract. They're all contracting with each other and saying, well, we all agree to do this to increase our leverage. So actually, I'm not torn at all. It's the fundamental essentials of contracting working towards a balanced economy. Hypothetically, we'll see if it actually plays out. But I'm all for this, and I hope the smaller labels get more leverage, particularly in a world now where the bigger labels don't have the powerful grasp they used to have on music.
Yeah, I saw this and I'm like, I agree with you, John. I just, you know, this now what I worry about though is that you're gonna have two huge factions fighting against each other. It'll be like the major streaming sites versus this giant union, and I think, and honestly, if the streaming sites had just, you know, been a little bit, just been more gracious and in good faith, maybe paid a little bit more, they could have avoided this whole thing, and now they're going to have to deal with this.
Do they even care, though? I mean, is this 5% of their income, you know? I mean, let me tell you, Drake sells, you know, 10,000 to 1 to, you know, Superchunk.
Yeah,
I mean, is it even 5% of their income?
I don't know, but I'm not sure. But I think this, I think you'll see more labels, maybe even more, you know, indie majors get on there, and eventually that's going to add up. And it'll be good for Wynn because they'll have a ton more people and they'll have more, you know, more to bring to the table. But you know what? This whole thing could have been avoided if, you know, they had just not, if they had just been fairer about this. And now they have, now they're going to have a huge monster to deal with. And honestly, they, the streaming services deserve it. So I'm in favor of this too.
I just feel kind of cynical about it. I just feel like it's going to end up falling apart from infighting, or it's going to somehow get co-opted, and whatever victories they have are just going to end up helping major labels down the line, like anything with regards to payment. It kind of reminds me of Record Store Day. That's one. You know, every year you see more and more major label stuff getting re-released on vinyl. It reminds me of when iTunes, iTunes switched their payment plan set up. It was going to, everything used to be 99 cents a track, didn't matter who you were. And then it was like, well, we'll go by popularity and we'll let the market decide. And everything got more expensive and everyone is still miserable. And like, I like it in theory, but that's all it is to me. It's a theory.
You know, I agree with that too. I think, I mean, it'll have to be managed really well and hopefully there won't be infighting, because really they're all fighting for the same thing. But I agree. I mean, yeah. Someone could cause trouble in there, and the whole thing is in danger of falling apart. But that's also just because I think it's a new idea. So I think we just have to let it play out and see what happens.
That's fair. That's fair.
All right. Well, I guess we'll move on here to the conclusion. We're assuming it's a conclusion to one of the more shocking things that kind of came up in the past few months. So this is likely wrapping this saga up, but Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes has responded to Joan Harris's apology for accusing him of rape earlier in the year. So this became last year, actually, when Harris, in an online post, accused Oberst of raping her after a 2003 show. So quickly afterwards, he denied the accusation, and then he filed a lawsuit against her for the false accusation. Now, his attorneys have been trying to contact her for 6 months and had no response. And then just a few days ago, she issued a complete retraction to the accusations and issued an apology to the legal team. I'm going to pull that up here and just read you here. She said, "The statements I made and repeated online and elsewhere over the past 6 months accusing Connor Oberst of raping me are 100% false. I made up those lies about him to get attention while I was going through a difficult time in my life and trying to cope with my son's illness. I publicly retract my statements about Connor Oberst and sincerely apologize to him, his family, and his fans for writing such awful things about him. I realize that my actions were wrong and could undermine claims of actual sexual assault victims, and for that I also apologize. I am truly sorry for the pain I have caused." Connor responded, and his response is, I've accepted her apology and retraction to clear my name. This has been an extremely difficult and stressful time for me personally and for those I love. I'm appreciative of the family, friends, fans, and business partners who supported me throughout this, and look forward to happier times as we all move forward with our lives. So he doesn't say explicitly that he's dropping his lawsuit, but in light of the statement, that may well be the case. This is over. Is this what we saw coming? Is this what people expected? I have a feeling that when this story was announced, there was a lot of talk about the accuser, and a lot of people felt it was less than credulous even at the time. But something like this can just destroy you.
Yeah, I'll break the ice on this one, because this is a very difficult subject. The fact is, women do get raped and even date raped rape can mean a lot of things. And that, I mean, like, sometimes raping is, you know, jumping from the bushes on a girl, but sometimes it's having sex with a girl that says she doesn't want to have sex, but then having sex with her anyway. That's all rape. So it's a very touchy subject. So we're very interested in protecting women who have been assaulted or raped, because we don't want them to feel as though they'll be attacked if they've been raped by society, whatever. I guess the unfortunate consequence of that is that a mere accusation now is very, very deadly. And I don't know if there's a percentage. The percentage is probably very small. But the fact is, there are false rape accusations. It might be very small, but it does happen. And the problem is, when you're accused of rape, you have two options. And neither, if you're accused of rape and you didn't rape somebody, you have two options. And neither is really a great answer, but you got to do one of them. The one thing you can do is ignore, which is probably a bad decision all the time. Say, well, if I ignore it, it'll go away. The problem is, I don't know why, but in today's society, if you ignore something, even if it's an anonymous accusation, then people say, oh, he's guilty because he didn't say he didn't do it, which is not how our society is built up. You know, we're an innocent until proven guilty society. But for some reason, with rape claims, people seem to think you're guilty until proven innocent, which I think is a fallacy. But that's the society we have. So what you have to do, and what Conor Oberst did, is if someone accused you of raping them and you didn't, you have to say, no, I didn't, right away. And you have to act assertively to say why you didn't. The problem is, when someone accuses you of rape, even if you didn't do it, it's always going to stick with you. Like, people say, well, he denied, but he still probably did it. Even if you didn't do it at all, it's an unfortunate consequence of society. So what you have to do is just, you know, muscle through it, grit down, show that you didn't do it, and then, you know, say, I guess you have to just deal with the unfortunate consequence of merely being accused means you're forever guilty in some people's eyes. It doesn't look like Conor Oberst is going to proceed further against this, and I think that's smart, because basically he's shown society that because he was so confident and assertive and had evidence that he didn't rape her, I think very, very, very few people think that he raped this woman. And I think this woman's probably mentally unstable. I don't know that, but if you just see how she's reacted, how her story has changed, and actually if you look at the physical copy of her note, it doesn't look like it was prepared by an attorney. It looks like she prepared it herself. So I think she's just having a rough time, or she's in a bad situation. That being said, it's bullshit to accuse anybody of rape if they didn't rape you. I mean, that's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing to do. And so I think we need to figure out some way as to how to prevent this. And I think it underscores the fact is, right now, I think there's sort of a real problem in punk rock. Is in the past 4 or 5 months, I know 5 or 6 people that have been accused of raping someone, but the accuser is always anonymous, and then they say, well, what did they do? And no one says, well, I'm not going to say what they did, but they did something really bad. I've seen it happen like 5 or 6 times, and it's a terrible thing. And like I said, if you address it, then people say, well, he's a rapist because he addressed it. But if you ignore it, it just gets worse anyways. So it's a bad situation. So even though it might be a very small percentage, false rape accusations do occur. So if somebody's accused of raping someone, they're not automatically guilty. It's innocent until proven guilty. Just because you're saying, I don't know if this guy raped this woman, doesn't mean you're saying that woman's a liar. You're saying, I don't know, she could be right. So just keep that in mind. It's an innocent until proven guilty society. A mere accusation does not mean someone did something bad.
I honestly hope he proceeds with the lawsuit. I mean, what she's done is, you know, it cheapens the legitimate rape claims. So I hope he takes her for everything she has. This is completely libelous. I don't know why he would stop, but I mean, if he just wants it to go away, that's fine. But if it were me, I would go after her even more.
I don't think his woman's all there. She could be, but I don't think she's all there. The only thing that could look bad on him for, like, driving this woman into the ground, like, don't you think he's won, you know, like, quote, won?
No, because she dragged his name to the ground.
She did. I mean, she hurt him. And people totally believed her in the beginning. She hurt him pretty bad.
Yeah, so I don't know why. I mean, if he wants to stop, that's his decision. I'm not saying that, but if it were me, I would go full throttle.
Hmm.
Because I mean, it's just in principle, it's just another thing. Well, this happened, so we don't know if we should believe this case now. We don't know if she's stable and all this thing. When it could really, in fact, be a legitimate claim. So it cheapens legitimate. These kind of situations cheapen legitimate rape claims.
Ricky, what do you say? I'll give you the tough question, and you don't have to answer this tough question. Let me play devil's advocate. There are still people out there that say, well, because he's so rich, she probably was raped anyway. This is hypothetical. This is not true. But there are people that are saying, because he's so rich, even if he did rape her, she would back away because she's scared of getting a lawsuit. So this is a bad guy getting away with something just because he has lots of money.
give it. You know what? He can give the money to charity.
No, but I'm saying he's not going to get any money. She's got no money. He'll never get any money from her.
Oh, okay.
But I'm saying people are saying because he could hypothetically sue her and win. Well, I mean, he could win millions of dollars in a lawsuit like this. They're saying that even if she was raped, she would say she wasn't because she's scared of being sued now.
Oh, you're saying so it could have been like it actually did happen, but now she's taking it back because she's scared of being sued?
That's not what I'm saying, and I don't think that's true. But there is a small but vocal minority of people saying that she this is the small minority saying she probably was raped, but because he's so rich and could sue her for because she doesn't have enough evidence. She retracted her statement, even though she was raped.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. I mean, honestly, I guess there's that burden of proof there, huh? That's a good point. You know, I don't know. I mean, if it really happened, I mean, it would have to be proven, I guess. Ugh, that is a mess.
Well, I'll tell you, here's John Gentile's solution, and John Gentile's not an expert in this, and he very well could be wrong. I think in order to avoid this is we need to set up a better system where when women are raped, they feel safe quickly after it happens, so they can go to a place, you know, and collect evidence or file a report or something.
Oh, but yeah.
The quicker you move, the better, the more evidence you have. You know, 10 years after the fact, that's a long time.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. Like girls, women don't they feel ashamed, and what happens is they hold it. They don't tell anyone for a long time. Then there's no way to prove it.
So I agree. So I think we need, you know, maybe Planned Parenthood or maybe hospitals should have some type of a specific training for that situation, so women don't feel ashamed or feel as though they're helping themselves by going to these places, so you can get that earlier on. That way you tend to avoid this problem.
Now, at the same time, even if she's retracting and she really were, this really was a false claim, though, I mean, I would what I'm noticing about just, my generation and a lot and what like the newer generation is that no one's taking responsibility for anything. And by just suing her, and granted, he's rich and he'll get whatever he has. He can do with it what he wants. But at the same time, she has to be held responsible for just, you know, cheapening the legitimate rape claims.
That is a good point.
I got to tell you, like this, and even if he doesn't have money and he wins a lawsuit and he doesn't get anything, the one thing that everyone forgets about lawsuits when they're getting sued is that your credit rating will get destroyed if they're successful in suing you.
Ricky, I agree with you most of that. I don't think this lady's worried about her credit rating.
Oh, that's I'm just saying in general, though.
Yeah.
Getting back to Adam's question about the story, whether or not it's over, I think it's going to have a second shelf life the next time something like this affects our general music community. I guarantee, like, you guys have already started talking about how it's going to cheapen other claims. I'm just going to use the phrase sexual assault instead of rape, if you guys don't mind. Go a little broader. It lasts, like, what, like 4 to 6 months? Like, I've seen stories about, like, there's that casualty story that ran. There have been rumors about Cheap Girls. There's going to be another story about another band possibly sexually assaulting a fan. And the Oberst thing is going to come up as an example of, well, maybe she's lying. I got to be honest, John. I kind of, like you were talking about how it feels to be accused. I feel like our society tends to shame victims, and that's why they don't come forward. They don't go through with test kits. And I think we have a blame the victim mentality. People are going to want to know, well, how were you dressed? And were you drinking? And what else were you doing? And did you know what was going to happen? You went to a show. People use the same rationale for when, like, people get hurt in a mosh pit.
Well, I agree, and that's kind of I think we need to develop systems, you know, like at Planned Parenthood, where
I'm a really big fan of RAIN. It's the Rape Abuse Incest National Network. My wife and I used to be more involved with them. Every year they do this thing called RAIN Day. At our college campus, we pass out literature, so you can kind of let people know what resources you have. If you're on a school campus, it's always good to, you know, talk to your counselors. You can always go to teachers. Parents are always a good authority. It's really hard to get tested right away. My sister's first roommate, her very first month of college, was raped. They didn't get the she didn't know about the kit. They didn't get any results from it, and she just kind of had this stigma for the rest of the semester, where everyone just like she accused this person was on the soccer team, and it was she ruined his career because now he can't play soccer. He got kicked off the team because of these accusations, and poor him. And she just kept getting shamed and shamed and shamed. I feel like stories like that and like this are just going to keep making people afraid to speak up. But and so that really frustrates me about this.
That's what I'm saying. Is I think we need to correct the problem as soon as it happens, you know, like not shame the victim. That way victims aren't scared to come forward. Because, I mean, the reason society shames victims isn't Conor Oberst's fault, you see.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
So it's wrong for Conor Oberst to be taking blame for this thing 10 years ago. But equally, it's society's fault for making it more difficult for victims to come forward as soon as it happens. So my point is, and I think it's a solution, but I'd be wrong, is that I think society needs to make it easier or more protective for victims to come along when they're raped, at very close to when they are raped. That way, you can really get the bad guys, you know, and then you can cut down on the small percentage, but visible percentage of false rape claims. Do you disagree? Mm-hmm. You
can I agree. I just – I don't know how easy that is to accomplish.
Well, I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying it's necessary because, I mean, this is not Conor Oberst's fault, you know.
Oh, I agree with what you're saying there.
I think you're also going to have an you're always going to have the issue of burden of proof also. I mean, maybe the guy on that soccer team, I'm not like saying – I don't know exactly what happened, but he could easily say back, no, it was consensual. Because no one was there and no one witnessed anything.
Yeah, that's a problem. But I mean, like,
unless you see like blatant bruising and beating, that's your issue. It becomes a he said, she said kind of thing without real proof. It's all circumstantial proof, not like actual, you know, right here, this is it, kind of proof. You know.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Let's talk about Tommy Ramone again. I feel very sad now.
So, like, should I play a goofy song?
Yeah.
Like, Jesus.
Weird Al.
What? No. Yeah, how do you seg out of that into something not that? All right. So, anyways, as a palate cleanser for this whole unfortunate storyline, we're going to completely change gears and moods and everything else. So I'm going to play you a song from a band out of – they're originally out of Waterloo, Ontario. They just moved up to Toronto. The band is called Sam Coffee and the Iron Lungs. They have a new record that's coming out on Southpaw Records on June 20 – or was it June? Oh, it's already out. Okay, cool. June 24th, it came out on Southpaw Records. The album is called Gates of Hell. It follows up a 2012 release called Shin No Skin that he released. This new record, some parts of it were recorded by Ben Cook of Fucked Up Young Gov. John, you're a fan of Ben.
I am, yeah. Actually, yeah, Ben Cook's cool, man. Actually, did we debut that Sam Coffee song?
I don't know. We might have.
Yeah, Ben Cook reached out to Punk. This might be that song. Ben Cook reached out to Punk News and asked us to premiere it. That might be this song. So that's cool. Well,
let me make sure that I'm not playing that song. No, I'm not. I'm playing a different song. So there you go. Yeah, this is we put the song Calgary Hill on the site back in May. This is a different one from that same record, and it is equally fun and crazy and just really good power poppy garage rock. You know, if you're a fan of, you know, I want to say like early Black Lips or a bunch of the stuff that Dirt Nap releases or just, you know, being happy, then this is something that you will like. So this is Sam Coffee and the Iron Lungs. The song is called Hold Me Close.
Yeah.
right, and we are back. So that was Sam Coffey. You should go check his stuff out. It's super fun. We have a couple more stories that we want to get through this week. First of all, the video that accompanies this is super amazing, is that an eighth grade metal band has signed a $1.7 million deal with Sony Records. So this is a New York City-based band called Unlocking the Truth. The deal that they've signed is, well, it's potentially worth $1.7 million. So what makes the signing really notable is that the three-piece, all the members are in eighth grade. The band previously opened for Slipknot's Joey Jordison's band Scar the Martyr and played at last year's Coachella. So under the deal the band has signed, they have two albums to start with. They're going to make $60,000 on the first disc and up to $350,000 on the second. Following that, Sony has the option to sign the band for four subsequent albums, which would make the deal worth about $1.7 million when you add it all up. The mother of one of the band members stated, "This is so exciting. We're jumping over the moon. What started out as play dates went to Times Square and now this. It's been one great thing after another." So there's video on Punk News you can see of the band like performing in Times Square just on the street. And yeah, these are 8-year-olds and they're amazing. So I don't know. This is fun.
The system works.
Yeah.
They're not 8 years old. They're like 13 years old. They're in eighth grade, right?
Oh, I'm not interested anymore.
Okay, fuck. Never mind.
Yeah, okay, sorry. They're in eighth grade.
But it's older kind of than that. When I saw the story go up on the site, a lot of the commenters are really shitting on this whole story, and I really have a hard time feeling bad or anything like that. I think I feel great for these kids, and let's be honest, they're not going to be getting $1.7 million out of this. I mean, they might get the $60,000, and they get a record. They might get two records out of it. They're going to get a lot of exposure, and good for them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have any illusions that this band is going to change the world or anything like that, or they may completely disappear, but I'm just looking at it from the perspective of, like, you're not even in high school and, you know, you're rocking out with your cool little three-piece metal band and, I don't know, you're good enough at what you do that, you know, you get that kind of attention and that kind of, I guess, like, potential money thrown at you. Like, that's a huge confidence boost for, you know, for some kids that, like, could one day, you know, maybe not this band, maybe not, you know, this exact thing still, you know, they could one day be some serious musicians that
I think it's very cool.
Yeah.
My hope is they end up kind of like Ben Queller was what, 14, 15 when his band Radish got signed, and like his record didn't sell well, but it gave him a lot of insight into the business. And later when he went for a solo career, He was able to make, you know, informed decisions that he might not have made if he hadn't had that experience. So hopefully, if they do stick with music, this will pay off down the road.
A lot better use of their time than, like, sitting around playing Xbox or something.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Maybe it'll pay for college. Oh, that'd be so cool.
As the site's 12-year-old, it makes me wonder what I'm doing with my life.
Oh, you're never going to live that down.
Nah, but I mean, I think I remember seeing the Times Square video like maybe a year ago. It's, and now seeing them go get a one, you know, potentially $1.7 million at, you know, 14. If I were them, why even go to high school? Why not just pursue this?
Don't get an education. You don't, like, need that anymore.
Honestly, like, I'm sure they'll probably be in class like in September seeing like, why are we doing this? You know, why?
Because a major level record deal has never led anyone wrong.
Seriously.
Fuck Earth Science. I'm going on tour.
I mean, that's the funny thing here is, like, we see a bunch of eighth graders get like a major label record deal, and we're like, this is amazing, good for those kids. But then, like, some punk band that we like that has no money would get a major label record deal, and we'd be like, fuck those guys.
Fuck them.
I'm just going to jump in here real quick. I thought it was very interesting that if you saw this news article on heavy metal websites, people were like, yeah, keeping heavy metal alive. Great for these kids. I'm so happy. This is awesome. But then you go to the punk rock website, they're like, these kids are stupid. Their music is terrible. First of all, it's like telling a 14-year-old their music sucks. A grown man, it's like, what's wrong with you? But I just thought it was it says quite a bit about the mentalities of both genres that the heavy metal websites were like, this is the best thing ever. And the punk people, some punk people were down with this, but some punk people were like, this is stupid. They're getting abused by their label. I feel so bad for these kids. Or worse, these kids suck. I hate them. It's like, you're 14, you know?
That's why Yancey and I prefer metal now. It's warm and welcome. Heavy.
That is true. Of the few heavy death metal shows I've been to, everyone's really nice, as opposed to like hardcore shows. I mean, I was very surprised when a friend of mine took me to see Cannibal Corpse. Everyone was very nice.
Well, let's also be very nice when talking about Green Day.
No.
Nice.
Anyways, Green Day is fun. No, okay. So, Mike Durant of Green Day has plans to produce an independent film. The film will be called Crickets, and it will be co-produced by Green Day's manager, Pat Manageriella. What is his name? Pat?
That's not
Magnarella.
Please let that be his name.
Yeah, I'd like that to be his name. It would fit. With a script written
Pietro Magnarella.
Yeah, so anyways, the script was written by Alfred Botello. So the story features two estranged brothers. One of the brothers is a stand-up comic who is dying of a terminal illness. He asks his brother, who works at an office job, to go on stage to perform his act in order to evaluate his own work. Durant stated, I, and a lot of people, have been affected by illness, and it's a very relatable thing. I'm just kind of tired of junk food movies. Here's something that's feel good, feel bad, and feel everything movie. So there you go. Mike Durant is into the film producing realm. I don't really know if we can comment on this because none of us have actually seen this or know anything about film.
I gotta tell I'm assuming. One commenter has it perfectly. They said, this sounds like the plot to the Adam Sandler movie, Funny People. And he's right.
A little bit.
Yeah, I mean,
look, the last four Green Day records sucked.
Oh, five.
You know what? I'll go to bat for American Idiot. I think it has some good songs. It hasn't aged great, but it's got some good songs. That being said, I think it's good he's doing something totally different. Because he needs a break.
Oh, that's not nice praise. All right, I'm going to jump away from this one because we don't really need to dwell on it. There's not much to say. But this one is wonderful. At least from a commenting perspective. Ben Weasel.
Here
we go.
The ever-loving frontman for Screeching Weasel and is infamous internet supervillain is now crowdsourcing funds to create a new Screeching Weasel album. He states that the album will be the first part of a two-part rock opera and will be titled Baby Fat Act One. Specifically, he's hoping to raise $27,000 to make this thing. As for why he's crowdsourcing it, Weasel states, simple. Capitalism is dead in the record industry, at least for us small fries. We're back to the patronage system. And if you're the modern day counts, queens, and dukes who will decide whether this record ever... And you're the modern day counts, dukes, and queens who will decide whether this record ever sees the light of day. So, yeah, you can find a link to it on Punk News. It's all over on Indiegogo. As of this recording, there is $21,820... raised of the $27,000 goal. That's 81% to completion with 27 days left. The campaign kicked off on July 13th and it'll close on August 13th. So there you go. Screeching Weasel crowdfunding going on. John?
Yeah, I actually have a very strong opinion about it. Well,
I figured you would.
I don't care about Screeching really? Weasel. Screeching Weasel is not a I think they're way overrated as a band. He hit a girl. That's lame. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world what he did because she spat on him. But you shouldn't ever hit women. That's lame. I don't care about Screeching Weasel. What I do care about is I think his and Ben Weasel's a jerk. Everyone knows it. But you have to give him credit. I agree with it, the statement that we're back to the patronage system, and you're the modern-day counts, queens, dukes who will decide whether this record ever sees the lights of day. And I've spoken about this on the podcast before. Actually, I used almost that exact phraseology, saying that where, you know, Kings used to sponsor artists, that's where we're back to. And I don't know if it's a good idea for artists to be so closely beholden to their benefactors or funders. Because I think artists generally make their best work when they're not beholden to anybody. And so if they're directly working for people to make work, it's not so much art as it is a work for hire. And so I think that this is one of the worst results of the digital download, digital bootleg, digital illegal downloading age that we live in, and that artists now basically have to beg for money as opposed to being able to sell the art that they've made after they've created it. And I think it's a dangerous precedent, and I don't know how to correct it. I think people should pay for their music. I think artists should be well compensated, not insanely compensated, but well compensated. And I think the result of artists having to beg people for money before putting the record together is pretty lame. Although I do say, I think Screeching Weasel probably has got $27,000 in the bank account. They could have recorded this themselves. They just didn't feel like it. That's what I think. I think the name of this record is terrible. Baby Fat. I don't want to send a record named Baby Fat. You know? So that's what I have to say about that.
I'm okay with crowdsourcing, though. Like, if you do it right, like, I think he has a modest budget that he proposed. And now any records he sells once the album's made, that's going to be a lot more profit for him. One guy that I thought did crowdsourcing really well was Matt Pryor from Get Up Kids. He did one campaign a couple of years ago, and all that money went towards his last two solo records plus a rarities pop. He threw a bunch of incentives in there, like you do private shows at like your living room or whatever. And I think stuff like that is cool. Like if you give people a breakdown of what the money's going towards, and it's something realistic. Like sometimes you hear stories about like no name bands trying to get a free van out of it, and those are kind of sad. I think like anything else, it's a tool. You want to make sure you use the tool appropriately.
You know, John, I agree with you up to a certain extent, but you know, when he says capitalism is dead in the record industry, you know, I think using a blanket statement like that is for him is kind of unfair, because you know, in order for people to want to, you know, people have to want to work with you, and acting like a jerk and, you know, hitting women, no one's going to want to work with you if you do those things.
True.
So, I mean, I got to tell you, I think in my view, it seems like every band is like a startup venture, and not all of them, not every business makes it, you know, and it's sad, but that's what happens. And I agree, you know, digital downloading is hurting that even more. But I think if you behave like a jerk all the time and do those things, you just lose all credibility, and they see you as a loose cannon. And frankly, no one's going to want to invest money into someone who they don't think can at least, you know, have some decorum, you know.
You're saying record label wise? Well, you're correct. Well,
record
that.
Label wise, and honestly, I'm not a fan of Screeching Weasel either. But if I don't, I'm not donating to this.
But Ricky, I agree with you mostly. I'll disagree in that other bands that aren't as jerky as Screeching Weasel have had to resort to crowdfunding. But the people have spoken with their dollars. This is going to get funded.
Oh, absolutely, and I agree that, you know, some bands that deserve to keep going are getting hit hard by downloading. They have been for a long time, but I think it creates a bigger burden of, you know, creative innovation, if you want to call it that. Maybe selling something, some kind of merch thing that is different than the typical T-shirt and record. You know, I remember going to a Menzinger show. They were selling Menzinger's flasks, and I bought that thing so fast. I mean, I thought that was a really cool idea. So I think I think that's what they need to do. I think just being more creative, but because the downloading culture is always going to be there. It's here to stay.
Not if John Gentile destroys the internet.
John Gentile's plan, I'll tell you, John Gentile's fed up with the internet. I actually agree with Ricky. I hope, just generally speaking, I hope there's a way that bands can figure out how to make a living without having to resort to corporate sponsorship or without having to resort to begging their fans for money. But I don't see that happening, and I think we're in a very dangerous era for artists.
All right, for our last story this week, why does this feel like this was seated just so John could yell? All right. Sam Hain.
Sam Hain! David!
Has announced more dates. In addition to the previously announced Riot Fest and Philadelphia show, notably, the band is playing live shows on both Halloween and the following day, which is November 1st, Samhain Night. So there you go. That's at the that's in New York City. The Halloween show's in Washington. Specifically, I guess we can just let you know all of these are playing Riot Fest in Chicago, and they're heading to L.A., San Francisco, Austin for something called the Housecore Horror Fest, Philadelphia, then Washington Halloween. Yes. And New York for Samhain Night. So, John...
This is going to rule. I've been waiting for this for 10 years. The last time Samhain did a tour was in 1999, opening for Danzig. But then Danzig's band wasn't at the height. But so I'm super excited for this. They're doing a full Samhain set. I love Samhain. In case listeners don't know, Samhain was between Misfits and Danzig. They're, I guess, heavier than the Misfits, but not as heavy metal as Danzig. They're almost more spookier or goth. I love Samhain. I'm buying tickets tomorrow morning as soon as they go on sale. I'm so excited. Like, this will be one of my favorite concerts ever. Like, this is a special concert, and I don't think Danzig is going to do it that often because he doesn't tour that much. And lately, this is a treat for fans. Every Danzig tour for the past, like, 4 years or so has been, like, a special tour. They do something unusual. So I'm super excited for this. I think this is going to be awesome. And if you like Misfits, Danzig, Samhain, or anything like that, you should go. This is going to rule.
Right. Well, I guess... Anyone else have any Samhain thoughts before we wrap this sucker up?
Actually, John, I'm curious. Do you call them Samhain or do you call them Samhain like Glenn Danzig does?
The way you actually pronounce it in Celtic is Samhain. But Danzig, sometimes he calls it Samhain. 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 But if you say Samhain to him, like, he doesn't get mad. But, I mean, like if I'm talking to somebody, I was like, oh, I love Mrs. I love Danzig. And then I say, oh, I love Samhain. I look like a dick because like, I'm trying to pronounce a word in English that isn't an English word that really has no English counterpart. Further, like it's transliterated incorrectly. The actual word is like Shawain, so it should have been translated like S-H-A-W-E-I-N. But whoever originally translated it did did it as S-A-M-H-A-I-N. So, I mean, unless you want to be a retention D-bag, just call it Samhain, you know.
And also, do you know or do you have any idea what the lineup's going to be for this?
No idea. I would guess, but I have no inside info. But I would guess there's just going to be Danzig's current band. Maybe Erie Vaughn's going to be there. But like, Danzig really is the main guy in all his bands. So I just want to see Danzig doing Samhain tunes. Like I don't even care. I mean, I would like it if some of the old school Samhain guys are there. But if it's just Danzig doing Samhain tunes, I'm loving it. I'm going to be there. I'm super excited. This is to me almost as big as Flag was last year.
Well, that's a big statement because you've been going absolutely Flag crazy for ever.
Well, the difference between that, I mean, Flag was one of the best shows I ever saw. Flag was so amazing. The difference between that is, you know, a lot of those guys in that band hate each other, and no one expected them to do those songs ever again. And then all of a sudden, they're like, yeah, we're doing Black Flag songs with Keith Morris on vocals, Chuck Dukowski on bass, insane. So I thought I would never ever see that. I'm not as surprised that Danzig is doing Samhain tunes because he was doing Misfits tunes, but I didn't know he would do a whole Samhain set, and he did it once before, 1999. So I'm super excited. This is going to be awesome.
But this is being advertised as Samhain and not as Danzig playing Samhain. So that's why I'm thinking it would be, you know, members of the original band as opposed to just Danzig and his band right now playing those tunes. Because honestly, if I bought tickets to go to see that, I would be disappointed if it just turned out to be Danzig doing a Samhain set.
Well, one of the guys in Danzig's band is one of the Samhain guys. It's what's his name? I'll look it up real quick while you guys talk. It's the guy that was on the third Samhain record. What's his name? Here we go. Steve Zink. He was in Samhain.
Okay. John, are you?
I would like to see, like, you know, London May. I would love to see Erie Vaughn playing with that also, but I thought they hated each other, so I'd be surprised.
I forget if London May, Danzig hates London May, or London hates, or Danzig hates Erie Vaughn. He hates one of those two guys.
I thought it was an Erie Vaughn Danzig thing.
Maybe, could be.
Well, that's a preview for what John's going to be talking about for the next 6 months.
Morning. I might do a really big article on it. We'll see.
10,000 words.
No, he's cool with London May because London May drummed in the 2012 Danzig Legacy shows. So he must not be cool with Erie Vaughn because he hasn't played with Erie Vaughn since 87. Oh, there wasn't Erie Vaughn in Danzig 1 through 4?
Yeah, Erie Vaughn played with Danzig until at least the second one, if not the third one.
So he's cool with London May, but not Erie Vaughn. So it's probably going to be Steve Zing, London May, Danzig, and maybe like Todd Youth or Tommy Victor. Tommy Victor, probably.
Well, it remains to be seen. So I think that's it for tonight. We don't have anything else. We can wrap it up.
Hooray!
Can we?
I think we're good.
All right. Well, anyways, so that's our show. If anyone wants to email us, it's podcast@punknews.org. Thanks to Joe and to Ricky and to Mark and to Mr. Gentile for being on the program. Yay. Anyway, so we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.